Good morning, and you are listening to A Public Affair. We have a special call-in show for you this morning. We have an entire panel of professional high-ranking firefighters here to answer all of your firefighting questions. This is a call-in show, so you can go ahead and get in line at 303-442-4242. I'm also going to be checking the DJ email, so if you'd like to send in written questions, you can do so as well at dj@kgnu.org. My guest today, I have Mike Palomera, Wildland Division Chief of Boulder Mountain Fire Protection District. Good morning.
Hey.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
All right. And Carrie Webster, Wildland Fire Senior Program Manager for the City of Boulder's Open Space and Mountain Parks. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And Michael Smitty Smith, Wildland Fire Operations Specialist with Boulder Fire Rescue Station Number 8. That's with the city.
Good morning, y'all.
Good morning. Well, you know, as we were out in the hallway and I'm trying to figure out who works for the county and who works for the city, it came out that there are 24 firefighting districts in this area. Explain, if there's a fire, who do I call? Carrie.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, Boulder is a very unique place. We've got a combination of different types of fire departments and fire districts, and some are paid. And some are combination where you have volunteers as well as paid staff, and some are all volunteer. So when you need emergency response, call 911, and our dispatch centers are the ones that pick the right location and get the right department moving your direction.
But what happens at the dispatch center if, like, you know, they put out a, you know, we have a fire on, you know, 25th and Canyon, do multiple agencies show up?
Potentially. You know, it depends, like, especially for wildland fire. When we get wildland fires, it might be in Boulder Mountains District with Mike Palomera. And at that point, he gets toned. The county as well with the sheriff's office has a fire duty officer that is on 24/7. And they have a crew and they respond as well. Other locations, you might get open space rangers, City of Boulder Fire, Fire Rescue, and the local fire protection district. It could be 4 Mile Fire. So the dispatch center is able to determine all of the necessary agencies that need to respond and get them going. And from there, someone like either of the Mikes that are here with us will be the ones they'll call additional resources, or whoever the fire district is, and get people in from all over.
I think for the sake of not confusing the listeners or myself, Michael Smitty Smith, you're just going to be Smitty for
Perfect.
Our purposes today. All right. Okay, Smitty. So as part of telling listeners more about yourself and the work that you do, I want to ask you to identify, for example, your particular district. Like, what is, of the 24 in this area, what is your particular district? What do you do there, and what are the biggest challenges?
Well, thanks for the question. So I work for the City of Boulder's Wildland Division. So our primary response is within the municipal boundaries of the City of Boulder. But we also have open space, mountain parks, lands all throughout the county. So we work in conjunction with a lot of the fire protection districts that have City of Boulder lands within their boundaries. I also am one of the incident commanders for the Boulder incident management team. So when incidents escalate beyond maybe local control, they can call in the next level of incident management. So that's one of my roles. And then I also play on one of the Rocky Mountain Area Complex Incident Management Teams as an operations section chief. So play all over the country.
So, for example, I'm thinking of the NCAR fire.
Yep.
When I went out to lay eyes on it, as news reporters often have to do, I remember seeing fire trucks from Thornton, from Denver North. What is the way, what's the nature of the collaboration in this Rocky Mountain area or in the Front Range?
So there's a whole process of as incidents escalate, and there's what we call mutual aid. And maybe to make complicated a little bit further, we have auto aid and we have mutual aid. So auto aid is when a call is pushed into 911. A lot of agencies in our mountain departments realize they can't do things on their own, and they have automatic aid agreements where other departments will be initially toned with them. Then as the incident continues to grow in size or complexity, we can start requesting additional resources. The Division of Fire Prevention and Control, that's the state of Colorado, has a whole system now for helping us bring in mutual aid from out of county. So we always start at the local fire protection district. Then it goes to the mutual aid partners within the county. Then if it gets really big, then we go outside the county and then potentially into our with our federal partners through the federal dispatching system.
And I'm not sure who is the best person to answer this question, but air support. Right now, the Boulder Airport is looking at possibly, well, how what shape it's going to take in the future. And one of the purposes, per my understanding of the Boulder Airport, is having wildfire fighting craft there. But again, going back to NCAR, remember that plane came from Texas, if I'm not mistaken? Like, what's the nature of even air support for fighting fires here?
There are, in the aviation side, there's the state controls on contract and owns a few aircraft, both fixed wing, the smaller ones, what we call a single engine air tanker, a SEAT, which is a small plane that can drop retardant. They have one larger air tanker, Tanker 10, that can put a lot more retardant on the ground. And they also have a fleet of rotorcraft helicopters that they can bring in to put that to use on whatever needs within the state. We most of our aircraft are what we call a national asset, and they are moved by the National Interagency Coordination Center to the areas that they see are where the potential is. So as areas start to dry out and heat up, they might start pre-positioning aircraft in the area. So, you know, NCAR happened in, what, April? So not really traditionally a high fire time, but that changes all the time. So I don't remember exactly where that aircraft came from. I don't think it was that far because it got here relatively quickly. I think it was one of the state single engine air tankers that came to us because we got some retardant on that fire pretty quick.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So Carrie, I have a question for you. You know, so we're talking about who all is in the pipeline, for example. You have people who have high-level expertise. How long have you been at this, Smitty? Because, I mean, everything you're describing as far as, like, interagency coordination, how long have you been working
in
firefighting?
I went fire primary in 99.
Okay, so that is...
So more than a minute.
Yeah, it's been a while. For example, you have younger folks who are needed to do, like, the heavy, heavy, strenuous work of firefighting. What all goes into getting up to that level? You're pointing at Mike Palomera, and you guys are pointing at each other. Mike, you answer that.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, just a little bit about myself. So I represent Boulder Mountain Fire. So it's one of the 24, you know, different fire agencies that we have in Boulder County. Our district's northwest of the city limits of Boulder. I describe it as north of Sunshine Canyon, south of Left Hand. It's about 11,000 acres, about 1,100 homes strewn within the foothills there. So we service a wildfire crew that also does wildfire mitigation work. And it's key to get, you know, young folks working into those positions. We bring out a seasonal crew every year. It starts generally in April and runs about through October. But I know the city and the county, and there's a number of local youth organizations that kind of can prep young folks for becoming a firefighter. And you can do this as young as 18 and kind of get your feet wet and jump into the career. So it's a good one to follow up.
Well, of course, we want prevention before we have an actual fire to put out. So I'm wondering, Carrie, since I tagged you for this last question, but you escaped it. So how about telling us what homeowners can do to help themselves to prevent the conditions that can eventually lead to fires?
You know, I think that is a great question. And I know that a lot of our residents on the western part of Boulder County are all too aware of the risks of where their homes are. And they've taken a lot of amazing measures to protect their homes and be independent in that way. You know, we can say that it's our federal partners that need to cut more, you know, open space needs to do more, county needs to do more. But at the end of the day, it does come down to the homeowner. And it starts with structure hardening, you know, from the inside of your house out and then into the vegetation around your home. And that plays not just for the western part of our county, but also for the eastern plains. So looking at your house, you know, making sure that you've got the right building materials. Is your roof a composite roof? We obviously in Boulder don't allow shake shingle roofs anymore, but making sure that you've got a nice asphalt roof, you've taken care of all the needles that are on that, you've cleaned out your gutters, you've swept up all the, you know, leaves and needles from around your structure, you know, removing the continuity of fuels, looking at whether things are right next to each other and right next to your house. What do you need to cut out of there? And then, you know, as you move out further from the house, it's picking the right landscaping as well. So choosing fire-resistant plants, generally, you know, this is a fire-adapted ecosystem that we live in. So it does need fire. And so it is a natural part of this. But picking our native species, that's a big thing. Usually drought-tolerant species are a little bit more fire-resistant. Things like yucca, yarrow, wildflowers, shrubs, you know, certain shrubs are better than others, right? But juniper is one of those big ones that we really don't like to see anywhere near homes. We've got a lot of ornamental juniper that's been planted in the 60s and 70s around here. So working on trying to take that out, some of our HOAs have done a great job with that, but it's a lot of work. But yeah, I think the big thing is just making sure that we're all, you know, as an individual homeowner, you're aware of these things. There's a bunch of resources on the State Forest Service site that can help you with that. We have foresters with the State Forest Service that you can call and ask questions. You can ask any of us, your local fire district, to help you kind of assess that. But I think we really need to drive home that the responsibility comes down a lot onto the homeowner.
Smitty.
Yeah, so you know, we've got a great resource within the county. The Wildfire Partners Program is a good one to get into. But really one of the biggest things that you can do is to remove all burnable material within 5 feet of your house. At the base of your structure, that's really, it's most times it's not a big flaming front that will take and consume a structure. It's after the flaming front has gone through or a spot fire that creeps up against the house. So if you eliminate the ability for fire to get to the structure itself, that's a really good thing to do. Looking at wood fences, you know, during the Marshall Fire, what we saw was that wood fences were acting as a fuse to the home. So what I would say to homeowners out there is look where needles and leaves and grasses accumulate throughout the year. Wind will create eddies as it blows this material around your house. And where those things hide, where you start to see that needle accumulation, that's also where embers are going to go in a fire. So if you can eliminate the potential for fire to get into those eddies where material builds up, and this isn't a one and done. You need to do this monthly. You need to make sure your gutters are clean, like Carrie said, the roof is clean, that you clean out all the areas around your deck, that your deck is well treated. Certainly wood decks are more receptive to fire than composite decks, but really taking the time to work through the process. But I would recommend that folks go to the Wildfire Partners website. They've got some great illustrated graphics that can help people look in the right places.
Okay, great. Well, we have some questions coming in already. One is from Steve. He says, I was driving down Lee Hill Sunday afternoon. I had a good view of what I think is Bear Peak. I noticed a large plume of smoke rising. I didn't hear anything about this. Do you all have information about this?
Yeah, so I can take this one. So the U.S. Forest Service has been doing some prescribed burning up near Gross Reservoir in that area. And so I know that's part of a larger project that they've been working on over the past number of years. And, you know, the reason that they do these prescribed burns, just kind of as a reminder, is to kind of help deal with the wildland fuel that would otherwise be in that area during a wildland fire. So some preventative stuff is what the Forest Service was doing. There.
And also, fire is a cathartic component of our ecosystem. So restoring the natural fire return interval to its where it should be before fire suppression happened is a really key part for us to stop fires from being healthy for the ecosystem, to help the fires do the good things and to stop fires from doing the bad things. So that Foresight 2 project is the first big reentry for the USFS in almost 20 years here in the Front Range, you know, in the Boulder area. And it was really impressive what they've done. And it was a lot of work to do prescribed fire in the Front Range. It's a challenging place to do it just because there are so many people that live here. They're actually burning about 1,000 yards from my house. And I think it's the greatest thing in the world.
And I would say from just a news perspective, they've been sending press releases to us about it. And they cite specific things like there's been some snow on the ground. There's been some precipitation. We see that we do have the conditions in order to do prescribed burns. And as far as getting the word out about it, I mean, I also see driving between here and Denver that they'll oftentimes put them, you know, just signs on the freeway. So you know what it is, right? You may smell smoke. It's this prescribed burn. We already know about it, right? So what all you're saying, it's a tremendous amount of work to do a prescribed burn, that this is like the first major reentry in 20 years. What all does go into a prescribed burn?
So that's one of my roles with the city as a burn boss. The wildland fire world is a lot like the Boy Scouts, as the longer you do it, your merit badges or qualifications. So as a burn boss, what you have to do is you start with all of the local ecologists. We call them the ologists because there's so many, you know, hydrology, you know, biology. There's all the things. So we start to look at what are the outcomes that we want from restoring fire. And so then we start to establish where we want to put the fire. And then from a set of objectives, we start working backwards. It's generally 12 to 18 months at a bare minimum to go from plan inception to plan completion. That's not even the beginning of implementation. So that plan goes through a bunch of technical reviews. You go through and you develop a set of parameters for where the fire, through modeling as well as experience, where we can keep it in the box, in quotations, how we're going to put fire on the ground safely. And then we come up with our appropriate staffing levels that we need to have in place, as well as contingency resources. So if fire were to get, if we were to throw an ember outside the line, we need to have X amount of resources that can immediately come in to back up the resources on hand. So there's currently up there's two hotshot crews on this prescribed fire. There's a bunch of engines from all over. I mean, we have two engines from the Angeles National Forest. We have two hotshot crews from Region 3, the Southwest. There are a ton of resources in there. And then there's a bunch of backup resources. But it is a significant process. And the other part of that is the public input and comment. So we want to make sure that everybody understands what's happening and all of those signs like you see on 36. One of the downstream effects a lot of people don't think about is when they see smoke in the air, they start calling 911.
Right.
Well, when that gets to the point where hundreds or thousands of people are calling 911 because they might not have known about it, that can impact our dispatch centers. So that's why there's not only do we want the public to know, but we also want to minimize the impacts on our dispatching system.
Okay. This is just a media question. I mean, we sometimes... when I'll get those press releases, I'll pass it along to the headlines production crew and say, hey, you might want to mention this. But that's just a real woof, a really quick, you know, headline in the morning. Maybe you weren't tuned in at, you know, 8:05 to hear it. Do you have any other PSA types of strategies or communication strategies to be able to constantly sending out reminders to people who might not have been tuned in at a certain time to know about these kinds of fires?
Yeah.
These prescribed burns.
Yeah, no, to be honest, part of the burn plan that Smitty was talking about does have a communication strategy, but we have some amazing communicators that are specialists in that. And so as much as you may hate it, social media has blown up. So the Forsyth 2 project from the Forest Service was all over Facebook. The Arapahoe Roosevelt National Forest has their own Facebook page, so it was up there. Twitter, it was out on Twitter as well. So we used those two quite a bit. Nextdoor has been something now that has become much more popular. So that's been going out, like, messaging through there. I'm trying to think what else. But I have to say social media has been the big one. You can also go to the Forest Service site. I can find that later, but you can actually sign up to get emails from them directly. And then you know all the stuff that's going on.
Okay. This leads to my next question. Alert system. There's like Everbridge. There's multiple competing platform. Like really... For folks who are just like, just tell me what's going on. What's the one that you would recommend if they only download and install one? Oh, Smitty, you are on the hot seat again. Go.
It's okay. So this is always a challenging one. Because obviously when we talk about objectives on a fire, our first and highest priority is firefighter and public safety. So how do we get the messaging out? First, you should go to the Office of Emergency Management's website and sign up for emergency alerting. That gets you into the system. I don't think there is any one answer, but that's the first place to start. We're in the process of rolling out a program called Zone Haven. And that, you know, you can find that on the OEM site as well. But there's a system, series of things that happens. There's the wireless emergency alerting network that, for better or worse, it's a big hammer to swing at evacuations because it utilizes cell towers. But when you push the message, you can't confine it to the exact area you want it to. So that's one of those very challenging systems that really does a good job, like the Amber Alert system. That's sort of the same thing. So when that button goes out, it can actually go to way too many people. So we're always trying to find the balance of evacuating the right people at the right time. But start at the OEM website and get signed up.
Okay. And again, that is BoulderOEM.com. That's the website that they're referring to. And they have, it's hard to miss where the sign up for emergency alerts. Okay. Well, we actually have a second question coming in via email. Do panelists feel that citizens and property are safe from wild and urban fire? In a perfect world, what would they like to see added?
Well, I can take this one.
Mike.
Yeah. So I think the term safe is sort of on a spectrum, right? One of the things is that everywhere in the Front Range and in Bullitt County is at some risk from wildfire, some areas more than others. So I think one of the messages that I'm trying to preach to folks in my district is there's a number of preventative steps you can take to sort of manage your risk. A lot of them we've talked about with regards to home hardening. There's vegetation piece for people's properties. But, you know, keeping up to date on evacuation information. I mean, where are the evacuation routes in your particular area? Fires at point eight, do you know how to get out? What, you know, we've talked a little bit about, you know, quote unquote, a go bag. Do you have all those important pieces that you need to evacuate your home safely? You know, one of the things we see is that, unfortunately, homeowners who aren't prepared tend to stay at their structure too long as they're trying to, you know, find all the important pieces, the stuff in the house. So, you know, safety is sort of goes both ways. There's a homeowner piece that needs to be done. And then, you know, from the emergency response systems, I mean, obviously firefighters and firefighter staff, you know, will do everything possible during a wildfire event to try and get folks safe. You know, the public safety piece is always our number one, and then property preservation number two. So that would be, you know, the safety piece for sure.
Listeners, if you are just joining us this morning, I have three guests, all fire experts in here. Mike Palomera, Wildland Division Chief of Boulder Mountain Fire Protection District. That's who you just heard from. Carrie Webster, Wildland Fire Senior Program Manager for the City of Boulder's Open Space and Mountain Parks. And Michael Smitty Smith, Wildland Fire Operations Specialist with Boulder Fire Rescue Station Number 8. We are taking your calls, so if you'd like to get on stack, the number is 303-442-4242, but I'm also monitoring the DJ@KGNU email address, and I have another one for you. Can someone give, and this is from the email, can someone give an update about a designated Colorado fleet of firefighting airplanes proposed and supposedly paid for by the federal government? We touched on that a little bit earlier, but
I don't know about the paid for by the federal government part. But the state of Colorado, the Division of Fire Prevention and Control, has, I believe they have two single-engine air tankers. They have one large air tanker. They have one Firehawk that's just come into service. It's going to be a huge asset for the state because it is a tanked helicopter, which unlike the rest, the majority of the helicopters that are out there fly with an external bucket of water, which really limits where it can fly, like over roadways and things like that. So that new Firehawk's going to be a great addition. They also have Canyon, I think another two heli-attack programs that are state programs. Then there are also federal programs that are around. So there are a lot of aviation assets available to us, and it all depends on where we're at indices-wise as to where they move. Our state resources move around the state, and our federal resources move around the country.
And I think it's just also, you know, it's also good to note that while we have these resources and they're very helpful, you know, the state also has the multi-mission aircraft, the MMA, which does reconnaissance flights for us, and it can do infrared, it can feed us live video, so it gets you a lot better situational awareness. But when conditions are really bad and we have high winds, which we often do when we have wildfires, they are grounded. You know, there's certain limitations at which those planes can't fly or those helicopters can't fly. So it might be frustrating as a citizen to see, you know, like, well, you've got this resource, why aren't you using it? Well, it's for the safety of that crew, as well as the firefighters on the ground and citizens. Just, you know, when it's too windy, they can't fly. Sometimes it's issues where we have drones. That's another big push that the state and all of us as firefighters push out there, is that if you're flying, we can't. So making sure that people don't have drones up in the air, because it can limit our use of aviation.
Right. And the high winds, that was something that happened during the Marshall Fire. It was so windy that firefighting aircraft couldn't get up into the air. Mike Palomero, you look like you have something to say.
No.
Okay. You just had this glint in your eye, like I want to add something. Okay.
No, I mean, I think all I'd add is, you know, this will be my 17th season. What I want to add is that the technology that's coming out in firefighting, and whether it's aviation or otherwise, is really astounding. And, you know, some of the planes and helicopters can do things that were unthinkable a decade ago. And so it's really, really impressive what these pieces of equipment and their crews can do.
Well, we are coming up at the top of the hour. I need to let you know that you are listening to KGNU FM 88.5 Boulder, KGNU 1390 Denver. We have a panel of fire experts here with us this morning. We are taking your calls, 303-442-4242, or online at dj@kgnu.org. One last question of this email. Would panelists be in favor of changing the current laws/restrictions dictating fire safety in Colorado? For example, would they be in favor of a permanent Stage 2 fire ban, or better yet, rewriting it all due to climatic disaster factor, i.e. the Marshall Fire?
Yeah, Carrie. Yeah, I'll take this one. You know, I have to say that I am not in support of going into year-round fire bans, or, you know, I don't think any of us are. We have so much federal land in Boulder County that, you know, it is public land, and people have the right to recreate on that land, and I know that I love to go out and have responsible fires in areas that are allowed to have that. And it's typically not like recreational fires and responsible people at campgrounds that are starting these fires. So I would like to, you know, I still think it's really important that we value our public lands and we get to go use them. And that's what makes people want to go out and protect our lands, is by getting to recreate in them. We do put in fire restrictions, you know, when we hit certain indices, when it's been this hot for this long and the fuels are drying out. Boulder County, in conjunction with the Forest Service, does implement fire restrictions at different various levels. Other things, you know, like City of Boulder Open Space and Mountain Parks, you're not allowed to have fires on that property anyway. So we already kind of have some year-round restrictions on some of our lands, and that's 46,000 acres that Open Space manages. You know, I think it's just, again, it's messaging and making sure that people are responsible. But we have groups that are out. I know the sheriff's office with their fire crew goes out and patrols campgrounds. So does the Forest Service. I know that the other agencies do as well. And so it's just, you know, making sure that people are responsible with their fires and put them out.
And I would just tie it back to, you know, tying the Marshall question into fire restrictions. We still don't know what the origin or cause was for Marshall. What I do know is that it was probably very unlikely that it was a campfire. So saying that a fire restriction would have had some sort of impact on the Marshall incident I was the incident commander for Marshall, and I still don't know what caused it. So it's people like to tie this big paradigm shifting event into other causes, and it's just important that we separate those.
So that leads me to a question that I've been wondering about is we often see, we don't know, for example, the Marshall Fire, huge. There's this demand also on the media of like, well, go investigate it. Why don't you know the answer to that? Why don't we know the answer to it? And then you look at other cases and so many are unclear as to the origins, but what is known is that most fires are usually started by humans. What is the capacity of fire investigation in this area?
So there's a couple answers to this. So, you know, when the fire's origins are believed to be on private, that falls to either the county sheriff or the local police department. As for the marshal, it was the Boulder County Sheriff's Office that's investigating it. And on a fire with such great impacts to lives and to property, they want to make sure that they have it exactly right. Because the minute that there is a cause announced, then lawsuits are going to fly. So I would say that the Boulder County Sheriff's Office has done a phenomenal job of taking their time, dotting their I's and crossing their T's to make sure that when they announce their findings, that that they have the science and the evidence to back up whatever they've found. As far as fire investigations nationally, there is a shortage of investigators. I think it's been in the media a bunch. There is a real push to increase the capacity within the investigatory abilities for both state and federal governments. But it is a hard job. It's an interesting job. The science of fire investigation is very cool. And if you can put your nerd hat on and that's your thing, those people are very good at their jobs. But there are times when we just can't figure it out. So, you know, we say it's either a naturally caused fire, generally lightning, or it's a man-caused fire. And that can be a train driving down the track, throwing sparks, to somebody throwing a cigarette out the window, a chain on a trailer, dragging. There can be all sorts of things. And a lot of people always want the answer. And sometimes it's just not possible to get that answer.
I have some more questions coming in via email. The phones are pretty quiet at this point. But if you do want to give us a call, the number is 303-442-4242. We have a panel of firefighting officials here. Carrie Webster, Wildland Fire Senior Program Manager for the City of Boulder's Open Space and Mountain Parks. Smitty Smith, Wildland Fire Operations Specialist with Boulder Fire Rescue. And Mike Palomera, Wildland Division Chief of Boulder Mountain Fire Protection District. Next question is, from a citizen's viewpoint, it is dark, wind blowing. I step outside and smell smoke. I can't see any fire. Where can I go online to get the latest information to let me know if there is a fire? And where is it so I can react appropriately?
Well, a lot of the times it's a chimney from your neighbor. So I would say pay attention to seasonality. I think for folks that have lived in the mountains a long time, they're a little bit more tuned into, you know, smelling smoke. Also look around, you know, is there a bunch of snow on the ground or is it a hot, dry, windy day? But if there's ever a question, then you should always call the dispatch center. You know, if you don't smell it, or I'm sorry, if you don't see smoke or flames, you might call the non-emergency number, but either way, contact dispatch and let the local fire protection district or fire department investigate it.
What is the non-emergency number?
303-441-4444 for the county, 303-441-3333 for the city.
Okay, good to know, because 911, I mean, everybody knows that one, but the other one's not so much. So I'm just going to give the follow-up to that that's in the same email. How do we verify that our contact info on Everbridge is correct? Is there a way to test it for citizens?
I would just, that might be a question for the OEM. If you want, I would maybe go back into the OEM website referred to earlier and see if there's an update link, but I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head.
Harry, I know for Larimer County, because I live in Larimer, so I'm signed up for the Larimer County alerts. I had to create an account and passcode so to get into that system. And so at that point, I can verify my information. I don't know if Boulder's system works the same way.
Well, BoulderOEM.com is the website for that. And
quick comment on the
yes,
sign
Mike.
Up. You know, one of the things is if there's different members in the house, make sure each one of them is signed up. Renters is another great one. If you've got renters staying in the house for a period of time, getting them signed up. We've seen a lot of if a single person is the contact for a house and that person's out of town, doesn't have cell service, whatever the case is, the other members of that residence don't get the notification. So sign everyone up. If you've got someone that's going to be in there for an extended period of time, they can sign up as well. But redundancy is always a good idea with that stuff.
Okay, last little piece on this question. The new zone notification doesn't have a feature online for us to double check which area our homes are in. Can that be added? That's a software question.
Zone Haven. So
the new zone
notification. You should be able to look at your address and see the zone that you're in at the Zone Haven Aware site online.
Okay. Okay. And Mike, you were talking about evacuation routes. Check and see what your evacuation routes are. How do people do that?
Yeah. So it's, you know, slightly different. I know in our protection district, we've got some evacuation route handouts. So, you know, depending on which neighborhood you're in our area, you may only have two or three areas to get out. So you can check with your local fire protection district to see if they have stuff available. You know, generally knowing the routes and even routes that aren't on the map, too. So knowing the area, driving these areas, particularly in calm time, is always a good idea. Because, you know, that if you have to drive these when it's smoky and there's a fire around and that, knowing where you're going, knowing what it looks like, you know, that's all a good idea pre-fire when the stress is.
And I'd also just say for folks to go and check out the Ready, Set, Go website. It gives you a lot of really good information on how to prepare to evacuate.
And then one more thing with evacuation routes. You know, we all think about it being in your home and having to evacuate, but we've got a large community that likes to recreate. So the other thing I'd have to recommend on evacuation routes when you're out on our trails is to check the weather before you go. You know if it's hot and dry. You know, you can see from the National Weather Service whether we have a red flag warning or a high wind warning or watch. So being aware of what's going on with those conditions, and then when you're on the trail system, making sure that you're aware of where you are and where you need to go in case something happened.
That was another anecdote from NCAR. Going up to NCAR, the people that were in the parking lot, it was either people responding to the fire, people covering the fire for the media, or very weary hikers being like, I just walked 5 hours to get back to my car. So that definitely is a point taken. Another question.
Piece, if I can throw
go ahead.
Just one of the other challenges that we face during these fires is people wanting to get home. So, I need to get home for my dogs. I need to get home for this or that. Really, what we ask is for you to think thoroughly through as we're trying to close areas. We're trying to get fire apparatus and resources in with everybody trying to go home. You really, if it's in high fire danger day, we would ask that you're prepared with all of the things you need with you, because you can really add to the complexity of an incident by hundreds of people trying to get home to get something.
I have a news director question for you, and that's, at what point should, what are the criteria that you would suggest, in your opinion, that should trigger breaking into regular programming to talk about a fire that's active? At what point is it like, okay, stop everything, we're going on the air and we're talking about this fire?
Yeah, boy. I mean, most fires in Boulder County, just sort of by definition, have a complexity portion to it. Proximity to homes and values at risk is pretty much constant around here. I don't know if there's necessarily like a size of fire, you know, if it's a half acre, don't, if it's an acre, okay. Do. You know, but I think depending on the day and conditions that might exacerbate the fire that's going on, you know, breaking in might make sense. And what I'd add to that too is, you know, a lot of the fire management, I mean, key part of firefighting overhead is that public information officer piece. And so that person's going to be looking at the incident. They're tied directly in with the incident commander. And so if we're on an incident where it looks like the wildfire is going to grow, it's going to increase in complexity, that incident commander is going to be in constant communication with the public information officer as far as getting information out to the media outlets.
And I'd say any time that as an incident commander or an incident orders evacuations, that's when we need the word pushed. As soon as that there, it's not a, you know, I'd say if we order evacuations, that's worth breaking in if it's within your area.
Yeah. I mean, my own personal criteria has been like, okay, pre-evacuations, like people kind of put on notice to that they might have to leave. But at the same time, you know, we have members of the public who get a little miffed if I don't break in. And, you know, for example, there's one on Easter, right? It was People's Crossing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So I got some kind of feet to the fire about why didn't you come in on Easter to, yeah. But that was Half Acre, for example.
It was a Half Acre. You had a lot of resources on it. And, you know, that was during that prescribed fire. So resources came from the prescribed fire and were able to help as well with the local department. City of Boulder was on it as well. You know, and at that point, they didn't issue evacuations. It was at night. Temperatures get lower. The wind, you know, I think there was wind that night, but it wasn't too bad. Mm-hmm. So without evacuations, you know, to be honest, we're probably a little jaded, but at that point, we're like, that's not that big a deal, right? So it is hard, but what is the criteria? I think I agree with Mike, with Smitty, with that evacuation trigger, you know, and if you feel like the pre-evacuation might be something, you know, and it's a really windy day, you could push it.
Right, right. For example, Sunshine Canyon, you
sure.
broke in.
But I would say if you're at home, there's a fire going on and you don't feel safe, leave.
Yeah.
There's no problem in leaving early. You actually are a part of the solution instead of part of the challenge presented.
Mike?
Yeah, that's part of sort of the messaging we're trying to do in our district as well, is that if you're a resident and you feel comfortable because there's smoke, or, you know, don't necessarily wait for someone to come tell you to leave. It's always a good idea to get out early rather than too late. So taking the initiative that, you know, yeah, my phone hasn't gone off to say I'm evacuating yet, but there's smoke going over my house, you know, use prudent measures to get ahead of that. And the other thing too, you know, we talked a little bit about the 911 emergency numbers. The local, you know, community email forum, you know, might not be, if you see smoke and you're concerned about it, you know, go through the right channels to get that addressed, because we want to make sure folks are staying ahead of wildfires and not falling behind the eight ball.
Okay. I have another question from the email. If you would like to email me a question, you can do so at dj@kgnu.org. And this emailer says, this might be more of a police question, given all the one exit streets on Shanahan Ridge, Silver Plume, Telluride, Smuggler, Redstone, Hardscrabble, Tin Cup, etc. How in the world do you safely evacuate all of these people with only one street to exit? Greenbrier or Lehigh? Telluride alone would have around 80-some cars trying to exit onto Greenbrier. A Marshall Fire-like situation with high winds blowing down on Shanahan would not allow enough time to get people off the ridge. We know the route, yet logistics, numbers, and time eliminate the safety. Who has an answer to that?
Well, it's always a challenge, but the emailer said there are actually signs up in the Shanahan neighborhood with evacuation routes. Fortunately, we have done a lot of mitigation work, open space mountain parks in that area to, you know, help us slow fire. We've also done prescribed fire up off of Hardscrabble in that same neighborhood. The other benefit that the city of Boulder has is that we have topography in our favor. We have wind against our favor, but from the city, you know, fire traditionally likes to go uphill. Wind can override topography, but we do have some time there. And it's our job as fire managers to do the best we can. Law enforcement are the primary people doing evacuations in coordination with the incident command team. But it's always a challenge. And when you live in an area that's adjacent to open space, that's part of the risk acceptance that you have bought into moving into that area. So having that ready, set, go process, you know, knowing what's key, what you need to take, what you need to leave, and when to leave, leave early. And if you can, just always pay attention to your ways out. For if you look at like what happened during the Paradise Fire in California, it was the same kind of thing. And what you need to know is like if fire's coming, you might end up wanting to go to the parking lot at the Fairview High School over there. Just knowing places that might be a safe refuge area if the fire's gotten there too quickly. There are days like the Marshall Day where getting people out. We evacuated over 30,000 people for Marshall. So it is part of the challenge of where we live.
Mm-hmm. All right. That was Michael Smitty-Smith, Fire Operations Specialist with Boulder Fire Rescue, answering that question. The next question from the email account is, home density was a factor in the Marshall fire spread and destruction. Boulder's so-called progressives on city council are pushing an increase of ADUs in town, increasing density. Is this a critical fire issue? Again, that is from a listener.
Well, building codes will always, you know, we have specific building codes within the city, and fire risk is always built into that. There are so many different components to this question. There are a lot of housing costs have become astronomical, so we have to come up with more housing somehow. That is not my area of expertise. But I will say that within the city, we have a fire marshal's office and a whole group of folks that look very specifically and very hard at that stuff. And the fire risk is not taken lightly.
Okay. Another question from the email is, what can you do if, let's say, I mitigate my home as best as possible, move flammables 5 feet away, limb up, clean gutters, rake, etc., but your neighboring homeowner who lives out of state or is a hermit or for whatever reason refuses to mitigate? Can you do anything legally or just grin and bear it? Ideas, Mike?
Yeah. So this is a pretty common thing we run into is fires don't see property boundaries, but property boundaries obviously exist. The first place that we generally like to start is by approaching the homeowner or even if they're tenants, but getting a hold of the homeowner and educating them generally will get us a long way. What we want to start with is the education piece for neighboring property owners. And that we've had a lot of success with that in our area of getting folks on board with what we want to do on their properties just by educating. It gets tricky when you get into the legal things and trying to force homeowners to do things on adjacent properties. It's not necessarily my area of expertise, but what I would say is it generally starts with a conversation. And we've had a lot of success because that's, all of our homes, right? They're all linked generally, particularly ones that are close to each other and properties. And so trying to take a community approach, whether that's a whole community or a street or a series of neighbors, but doing things together to build off of the benefits we've done on our properties really goes a long way.
Gary?
Yeah, and I think that this is kind of twofold here as well. We are now really looking at community wildfire protection plans. The county is going forward and moving on that. The city of Boulder is also working on a new community wildfire protection plan, CWPP. And those are really big ways. It's got a huge education and component to it. And getting these smaller groups together to really kind of have that feel and having that spark plug within the neighborhood that's willing to do the work. I think a lot of people are concerned that, you want to mitigate the property and it's going to cut all the trees. And once they see the good work that Mike Palomera's crew does, and it's not denuded of trees, they can get more on board once they have the education piece component, like along with seeing what the work looks like at the end. Wildfire Partners has had really good luck with that too. When several people start doing it, another person's like, that's not too bad. I'm okay with that. You can also potentially, if you want, offer to do the work for them, or have it contracted. We've had that work in New Mexico in an area that I was working at one point. But yeah, these CWPPs should hopefully really be a big push coming out. I know a lot of the mountain departments are doing them too. to really build some momentum and get people on board.
And going back to the education piece, that's what we're doing right here, right? So people now know the importance of keeping their the homes clear. I would say that I'm even guilty of that myself. So, you know, this is making me think like, okay, I need to go take another look at what's in the patio and like what you were saying about the eddies, right? Because, yeah, it happens. And I'm just like, oh, I already cleaned it. And now it's, I got the leaves over there again. I'll leave it for later. But no, I see your point. So it's like, okay, you've found one person that's like, okay, I understand now the importance. So hopefully there are other listeners out there as well. We do have a caller on the phones. Jim, good morning.
Hi. I was reading in one of the Forest Protection Journals something called Heartbeat that on the Forest Service, someplace that's like doing a lot of logging. Sometimes it's thinning, sometimes it's clear cutting, but that sort of opens up the forest and dries it out. And usually the logging companies want to take the biggest trees, which are the ones that are most resistant to fire, but most profitable. So there's a history of the Forest Service caving Louisiana Pacific, Georgia Pacific, all the different big logging companies to cut down the biggest trees. So they're just in it for the money. And the same seems to be true of, you know, the oil companies and the, you know, several utility companies. Places are just, they're causing climate change, making it so we'll have more frequent and more intense fires. So great, the city's suing the oil companies. And I just wonder, what's in the foam? Does it? I know there's a forever chemical that sometimes it's used to try and fight fires near airports. Is that getting in? Is that sort of a risk? Do you need to keep it out of drinking water supply?
All right. Thank you for your question, Jim.
Well, we don't have anybody from the U.S. Forest Service here. But what I will say is when everybody says that when we do thinning projects, when we do fire mitigation projects, that we're changing nature. The forest that we look at now is not in a natural state. With the elimination or the, you know, the suppression of fire since 1910, we have tipped the balance of what fire did, as I said, you know, that cathartic component of the ecosystem. Fire does good when it's behaving in its natural ways. As we've suppressed fire, the forests have become overgrown. They've become unhealthy. So what we look at and see out our windows is generally not what Mother Nature intended. So, you know, I'm not going to speak to what the Forest Service does or anything like that because that's not my lane. But I think there is a place for fire mitigation, for thinning. I think that some of the patch cuts that we see done on some of the landscape scale do help us, and it does mimic fire, where a fire would start, it would burn a couple of acres, and then you would see either aspen regenerate in there or just a stand replacement fire in that little area. So it's mimicking fire, and it also gives us a place from a fire suppression standpoint to take action. It also gives firefighters safe haven when we're fighting fire. We have to have what we call escape routes and safety zones. We need to be able to get someplace that we're safe if the fire does something unpredictable.
Mike?
Yeah, I'd just like to add to that, you know, one piece that sometimes gets missed in the mitigation thinning is the forest health component of this. The natural density of trees, like Smitty was saying, has increased. So when we see associated pests, insects, mountain pine beetle, you go to Summit County, a lot of property owners have dwarf mistletoe. All the things that sort of feed on trees, you know, the more trees that are competing for a finite number of resources, the less healthy the trees are. So forest health and getting the trees back to a healthy density where they should be is absolutely a piece of this, in addition to the wildfire mitigation piece.
Yep. And then the foam question, you know, there's lots of different types of foam, and it's used for different things. We have foam that's on our trucks. Some of the trucks have a foam system. With that, it does have high phosphorus and just other chemicals in it. So we are very careful when we are applying that stuff for keeping it out of waterways. You know, sometimes you have to get you aren't allowed to use retardant, even as an example, if you're near a waterway. So it is something, it's a great tool for us. It definitely allows us to use less water. If you think about it, our brush trucks often only have 300, 350 gallons. That doesn't last very long. And it's really hard sometimes to find places to go fill. It's not like we have hydrants everywhere. So the foam allows us to use our water longer. But yeah, we are careful in how we do it. Stuff for aviation is a little bit different. And I'm not an aviation firefighter, so I can't speak to that.
We are in the final 2 minutes of our program. Here's another coming in from the email. Having been in the fire biz some 50 years, please tell people to have a 5-pound ABC extinguisher. 2.5 pound is too small. And if they see an emergency vehicle coming, get out of the way. That's from Tom in Sedalia.
Always good reminders. Yep. If we can, you know, if we can keep fires small, that's the best outcome for everybody.
Great. And final question. Maybe you already answered this, but does the fire department contact KGNU? Or what is the best way for the radio station to get fire information from the fire department?
Our public information officers generally will be pushing press releases to all of the media outlets as soon as we have pertinent information to share about an incident.
Okay, well, we are in the final minute of our program. I want to thank Mike Palomera, Wildland Division Chief of Boulder Mountain Fire Protection District, Carrie Webster, Wildland Fire Senior Program Manager for the City of Boulder's Open Space and Mountain Parks, and Michael Smitty Smith, Wildland Fire Operations Specialist with Boulder Fire Rescue Station 8. Thanks to you all for coming. If you have like anything else to add, you have 45 seconds in which to do so.
I just want to say thank you for having us on the show and having this opportunity to share information with the public. Great questions.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I think this has been a really valuable hour, you know, and we're in it every day. And I think trying to push this information out to the public is a key part of it. So thanks for hosting.
Yeah. Well,
yeah. Thanks for everybody tuning in. And again, if you live in any place that is at all fire prone, take the time to do your work.
All right. Well, you know where we are, so we can do this again if you feel so inclined. Thanks to everybody who sent questions via email. You've been listening to A Public Affair. Up next is The Morning Sound Alternative with Sam Fuqua.